We've been looking at the book of Acts, if you remember. We're coming close to the end. Closer than we were when we were further than we are. Whatever that means. If you ask the average person, what is the book of Acts about? I'm not sure what they would say. They'd probably say something about the growth of the church, the start of the church. But as we look at it, there isn't really very much about church function or form or government. There aren't guidelines in there. Maybe what you see is that there's a zeal to reach the lost with the gospel, with the good news of Jesus Christ. Because without a knowledge of Jesus Christ, then we stand before God on our own merit. We can never stand before God on our own merit. There's no good there. We're next, chapter 23. Remember, we're moving fast, trying to get through this part because it's mainly just a historical end of Paul or his journey. Remember in Acts chapter 23, verse 23, they had just ordered 600 soldiers, Roman soldiers, to take him to Caesarea. So you try to think in your mind, the magnitude of the risk if they have to have 600 soldiers to secure his safety. We saw the 40 people who are committed to killing him. That was up there in the chapter. But he needs 600 soldiers to get him there safely. They really want to do away with him. Remember, the Jewish response is the zealot response, the Christian response. Often have the same kind of overzeal for something that can embarrass us, like the title of the book, Without Embarrassing God, you know. In a sense, the Jews here are embarrassing God because they aren't representing him faithfully. God didn't go say, kill everybody that disagrees with your doctrinal point of view, but this is what they wanted to do. And they felt they were doing God a favor, which justified that. Remember their response in 21:36, they said, away with him. In 22:22, they said, rid the earth of him, he is not fit to live. In verse 23:10, they're so afraid he'd be torn to pieces that they have to rescue him. Religious zeal without compassion is never a good thing. Religious zeal misplaced, claiming its righteous judgment, is often void of grace. Certainly does not reflect the heart of God. But anybody caught in apostasy, I don't know if you know what apostasy means, but an act defying what they thought was true about God, it justified in their mind the ability to be cruel and mean and kill them if they wanted to. So obviously Paul is public enemy number one. The 40 men that we saw in verse 13 and 14, who were not going to eat or drink until they killed him, must be getting pretty thirsty, pretty hungry, because he's going to be in Caesarea for 2 years. And I think they must go back on their vow just a little bit. So now we come to chapter 24. Well, I'll just explain it here for a little bit at the end with Felix in chapter 23. So he's removed by night. And then in verse 27, this man, Lysias, writes a letter to Felix. This man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him. For I had learned that he is a Roman citizen and I wanted to know why they were accusing him. So I brought him to the Sanhedrin, and I found the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him. So the soldiers carrying out their orders took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris, which is a fort halfway between Jerusalem and the coast, where the soldiers would rest on that 60-mile, roughly 50-60-mile journey. They put letter to the government and handed Paul over. The government read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." And he ordered that Paul should be kept under guard here in his place. Remember that none of these guys are just or fair or interested in justice. They are just power guys trying to keep their base. And a Roman leader keeps his base by providing peace in the land. All he has to do is, if he can keep unrest down, keep rebellion down, he's good. And he'll just do about anything to do it. And these guys are not good guys. In fact, in just a couple years from this, is called to Rome to answer for brutality that he'd done against the Jews, and he's dismissed from his place of leadership here. Chapter 24, 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea, some of the elders, and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. This is kind of political speak coming, if you know what I mean, when I say political speak. There's not a whole lot of genuineness in this next phrase, but it's what you did in that day. Remember, Felix is brutal to them, the Jews, and he will be even more brutal. Like I said, he will dismiss in a couple of years for his brutality. When a constituency of Jews will go to Rome and complain about his behavior. But you wouldn't know it by what he says now. "We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation." Doesn't say good reforms. Doesn't say bad reforms. It says reforms. Anyway, I'm just kind of buttering up the guy, I think. "Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. In order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly." So here you have the Jews who have in their midst Paul representing Jesus as faithfully as he possibly can, being as good a man as he can possibly be. He just brought a ton of money from all over Asia to help the poor people in Jerusalem. Here you have Felix, totally brutal Roman leader who never does anything except for personal gain that we know of. And how is it that the religious leaders are placating and playing up to this guy who's brutal and has no relationship with God and totally ignoring or trying to kill God's messenger? But isn't that what they've always done? Isn't that what he said? You always killed the prophets, you drove them in the pits, you never listened to my voice. "We will do anything to listen to any voice except for one that claims to be the one true God." And so many voices crash in on us. How do we discern which voice is legitimate? There's so many, and that's what when we had the whiteboard up here, we talked about the voices that come down to us and pound in our soul and give us direction. Which voice is it that we know of? That's when we use the Hebrews 4:12, "For the word of God is sharper than any two-edged sword, dividing between the soul and the spirit, judging the thoughts and intents of the heart." So to the extent that we stay in God's word, then we know right from wrong. If we don't stay in his word and get right from wrong there, then we're all on our own journey to find truth. Another phrase for that is anarchy. And it will result in anarchy and has resulted in anarchy. There has to be. Your existential journey, if we're all on one, then it's just whoever is strongest to force his existential journey on the rest of everybody else. So the Jews really miss the boat here. They end up being angry to the wrong person. Verse 5, "We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world." We talked about this before. He really hasn't covered the entire world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. So he sees him. "By examining him yourself, you'll be able to learn the truth about all the charges we are bringing against him." So everything that they said, for the most part, is not true. He's not been all over the world. He He is one of the leaders, but he's not the ringleader necessarily. And he didn't try to desecrate the temple. He was very careful not to. And they didn't seize him. The Romans seized him. I mean, if they had seized him by themselves, he'd be dead by now. And so it would be nice if while representing God, they were actually trying to be truthful in their accusations. That would at least go to their credit. But they're not interested in the truth in the slightest. They're only interested in the vengeance they desire on him. So, when the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense." What he's saying there is, I know you understand Jewish law, so I'll be able to explain to you what I have done and haven't done, and you'll be able to understand it. "They cannot prove to you these charges they are now making against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I do believe everything that agrees with the law and is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope of God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear between God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or these who are here should state the crime that they found me when I stood before the Sanhedrin, unless it was the one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. It concerned the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial for you today." And Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, had joined the proceedings. "When Lysias comes, I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs." So in a Roman court, you had to be able to present carefully what you, the presenter, the person making the accusation, and the accusation had to be clearly written and presented. Without them, there was no case. So technically here, there's not even a case because those people who are accusing him of being troublesome all over Asia are not even there to accuse him. 7 days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Jesus Christ. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, "That's enough for now." It's an interesting little statement there, you know. So Paul doesn't just talk about social issues. He doesn't talk about Rome being oppressive. He gets right down to it, right down to basically what God is always trying to get right down to. He discoursed on righteousness, which you need to have if you stand before God. Self-control, which is your inability to do the things that you need to do to stand righteous before God, and the judgment to come, which means what comes if you don't stand righteous before God. Felix was afraid. He said, "That's enough for now. I don't need any more of this convicting kind of thing, you know." And wouldn't it be fun to hear that stuff, exactly how he said it, because I have a feeling he has no fear at this point. God told him he's going to Rome. So he knows that. He's been beat up by everybody everywhere he's gone. He's been punished. We've read the list of things. So he's going to say the truth as he knows it best. And he hopes it'll help. And if they ignore him, he's used to that too. So he said, "That's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you." At the same time, he was hoping Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked to him. He said, "Last week, bribes are illegal in Rome. You should, you know, but that's the way they did it. That's the way they lived. Not by the letter of the law. Otherwise, he would have let Paul go for sure." Verse 27, when 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. Because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So obviously, he's still interested mostly in keeping his political savvy, his political calm in the area, more so than justice. He doesn't even, going out, he doesn't even pardon Paul. 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up to Caesarea, up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. We said this before. Everything to Jerusalem is up. It's always up to Jerusalem. It's always down anywhere else. So we should do that. It's up to Soldana or Kenai. I don't know where you're from. Sterling. Days after arriving, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented their charges against Paul. So after 2 years, they still haven't forgotten. They still have the number one in their hit parade of trying to get at him. They urgently requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, where they were preparing to ambush to kill him along the way. Now, they've been preparing his ambush for a long time. He was going to get killed up in Asia Minor, and they took him a different way, and he was going to get killed in Jerusalem, and the guards saved him, and he was going to get killed when he went to Caesarea, and they saved him, and now they're going to try to kill him when he goes back. I just want to make a little suggestion here. If your number one goal is to kill somebody, I don't think you're close to the heart of God. Am I okay there? Is that did I do okay? I don't know a lot, but sometimes I can get the general vicinity of right. So we know that the Jews here were not right. So then you'd ask yourself, well, when did they start going wrong? And they started going wrong a long time ago, if you read the Old Testament. This wasn't the first generation of Jews that went wrong. Now, within the Jewish culture, there were still individuals pursuing God carefully outside of that religious thing. Just like in our culture, there are still people wanting to know the infinite personal God outside of this religious trappings that we have thrown all over us all the time, which we know cannot be right. We cannot hate each other and say we represent a loving God. That's just not possible. So when the hate is there, when the lack of desire for reconciliation is there, something is wrong. It has to be there. It has to be there. It's supposed to be the mark that mark them to the world. The only thing we get is that it marked them for being instruments of evil to do harm. So they want to get him there. Those 40 guys are still waiting after 2 years. I don't know how many guys they have, but anyway. Festus answered, Paul is being held in Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me and press charges against the man there if he has done anything wrong. After spending 8 or 10 days with them, he went down to Caesarea. The next day he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before them. When Paul appeared, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many serious charges against him, which they could not prove. Paul made his defense. I have done nothing wrong against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. Festus, willing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, you're willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on these charges. Now we all know what happens if he's going to go there. He's never going to get there, right? This is the way that Festus can let them get rid of him without him specifically looking like he did an unjust judgment. Paul answered, am I now standing before Caesar's court where I ought to be tried? I am now. Excuse me. I've not done anything wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I'm guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Any Roman citizen at any point in their existence could appeal to Caesar. That would take him out of the hands of whatever court he felt he was being unjustly accused in. Paul, does he knows if they send him, he's going to be killed, so he makes this decision. After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, have appealed to Caesar will you go. Now, this is not all a bad thing for Festus. I mean, he's quite happy that it's off his plate and onto somebody else's. You see that in politics today sometimes. Verse 13. A few days later, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. You guys ever read about these guys? Agrippa is from that long line of Herods and all those evil guys that, you know, killed each other to get power and killed their brothers and killed their sisters and killed their wives. King Agrippa and Bernice, she's actually his sister, but they don't live as sister and brother. They live as husband and wife. And this doesn't, you know, how does that not bother the Jews, you know? I mean, it, more than what Paul's doing bother them? So, anyway, if you ever want to read a sorry, sordid lineage, this is one you can go back and read. Since they were spending many days there, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. He said, "This is a man, there's a man here who Felix left as a prisoner. But I went to Jerusalem, the chief priests and elders of the Jews brought charges against him and asked that he be condemned. I told them it's not the custom for the Roman custom to hand over any man before he faced his accusers and has an opportunity to defend himself against those charges. When they came here with me, I did not delay the case, but convened the court the next day and ordered the man to be brought in. When his accusers got up to speak, they did not charge him with any crimes I had expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus, who Paul claimed was alive. I was at a loss how to investigate such matters, so I asked him to be willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial there on his charges. When Paul made his appeal to be held over for the emperor's decision, I ordered him held until I could send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said to Festus, I'd like to hear this man. He replied, tomorrow you will hear him. And Agrippa now is going to hear Paul. The next day Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room, and the high-ranking officers and the leading men of the city. At the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. Festus said, King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man. The whole Jewish community has petitioned me about him in Jerusalem and here in Caesarea, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. Typical politicians, you notice that the whole Jewish community was the whole Jewish community. There were a lot of people who really liked Paul. It was just the religious leaders who saw him as a threat to their power base, and they didn't want to lose their religious power base or be held accountable for it. So remember, the Sanhedrin and the Sadducees don't even believe in life after death, so they never have to be accountable for anything, either on this life, or in this life, or in the next life. I found he'd done nothing deserving of death, but because he made an appeal to the emperor, I decided to send him to Rome. But I have nothing definite to write to his majesty about him. Therefore, I have brought him before all of you, especially before you, King Agrippa, so you may, as a result of this investigation, may have something to write. For I think it is unreasonable to send on a prisoner without specifying, charges against him. I picked up my wrong glasses this morning, and so I apologize for that. Can't read it quite as good as I normally would. So, anyway, it would be quite unreasonable to send a prisoner without a list of accusations. The Roman court did not take such things lightly. Life was cheap. They were very serious about what they did. And if you were not competent, you did not do the right thing, then you were just done away with. You just disappeared, or you were just set up to some island or did some menial task the rest of your life. Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. So Paul motioned with his hand to begin his defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against the accusation of the Jews, and especially so because you are well acquainted with all the Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. And he does know. His whole family knows Jewish culture. They worked within it, beside it, manipulated it for years to keep their power base. By the way, you know this is all going to fall apart in about another 10 years, and then it's going to go total anarchy, Jewish rebellion, the Romans are going to come down and crush them and turn their city to powder. The Jews, verse 4, the Jews all know the way I have lived ever since I was a child, at the beginning of my life in my own country, and also in Jerusalem. They have known me for a long time and can testify if they are willing that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee. And now it is because of my hope in what God has promised our fathers that I am in trial today. This is the promise our 12 tribes are hoping to see fulfilled, and they earnestly serve God day and night. O King, it is because of this hope that the Jews are accusing me. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? Remember, none of the things that Paul is claiming are strange to Jews. They've had prophets. They've had teachers come and teach and share with them. They believe in angels. They believe in visitations. They believe in all these things. And yet, when convenient, they would deny all the things that were the base of their nation for generations. I too was convinced that I ought to do all that was possible to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And that is just what I did in Jerusalem. On the authority of the chief priests, I put many of the saints in prison. And now he goes on and tells a story that we've read in Acts twice already, and this is the third time, right, of how he got saved. And I'm not going to read it again because you guys are pretty familiar with it. Saul, why do you persecute me? It's hard for you to kick against the goads. Supposedly, those are little pointed things on the front of your chariot or your cart. And if the horse kicked his leg back, it would dig in the horse's leg, keeping him from overstriding. These are the kind of things that he said, they just limit your ability to go ahead because it's punishing your forward progress. And I asked him who he was. He said, I am Jesus. And then we know what he did. And he went and he became a follower of the way. He became a Christian. Remember that the king, hard to think of the culture of the day. The king goes about only maintaining power by fear. When he can crush people, he'll do it to keep his power. Now, he must have had some interest in the afterlife. They all thought, well, what happened if I die? Will I continue to go on? But he never humbled himself in any way to an infinite personal God. He only tried to preserve the power that he had. And the Jews themselves are trying to preserve their power, which is what Paul was doing. But Paul had long since ceased to try to preserve his power base. He was only interested in one thing now, and that is sharing the gospel, the good news of Jesus, with anybody. He shared it as truth standing on its own to the Gentiles. He shared it with Jewish law to the Jews, showing how it fulfilled Jewish law to the Jews. And he actually believes, and is, I believe, not just toying with Agrippa, he's actually giving him the gospel as clearly and honestly as he can. Because some Roman leaders do truly get saved and become followers of the way. And so he is laboring to explain exactly how God changed his life. We said that the message of the New Testament, the promise of God's blessing, is the changed life. God will change your life if you include him and give him his proper place. If you don't give him his proper place, then you're on your own. The whole message of the Bible is to try to get us to believe that we can't make it on our own. We can't overhaul ourselves. We can't dig deep enough. I like to say it's like there's a basketball scoreboard up there, right? So here it is, the fourth period, and I'm behind 9,999-2. And I said, come on, and I'm the coach. Guys, if we dig deep, we can pull this out in the next minute. You know, that's foolishness. We can't dig deep enough. We don't have the ability, we don't have the time. There's no way we can dig deep enough to pull this out. The gospel message is that we don't have to dig deep enough. God dug deep enough for us. And he provided the atonement, the sacrifice of Christ, to cover that deficit that we could never do hard for Paul to convince a king that he has a deficit that he can't overcome, because the king has spent all his life bullying people to get what he wanted. But you don't bully God. When we stand before him someday, and he says, how do you? I don't know if he says how do you or not. You know, whatever he says, you know. Either stand in your own merit, or you stand in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, and I, for one, would prefer to stand in his righteousness, because mine isn't very good. Let's pray. God, you're really good to us. Thank you for that goodness. Thank you for changing us, helping us, giving us hope. Help us to share that light and that truth as kindly and graciously as we can. Learn to be honest with ourselves and learn to love you more. Yes,